Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue au dossier d'AMC, un balado sur les gens, les enjeux et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's Deputy Minister of International Trade, John Hannaford.
Voici votre animateur, John Hannaford, sous-ministre du Commerce international d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
OK, bonjour tout le monde. Ceci est une autre conversation en ce qui concerne la vie actuelle au sein du ministère. Et c'est un enjeu assez important aujourd'hui. C'est une autre discussion de la situation de race au sein de notre communauté et les considérations concernant notre travail en luttant, racisme. And I'm fortunate to have four colleagues joining us today. We have our special guest is Miriam Montrat, who is the head of our anti-racism secretariat. But we also have Jenna Hendricks-Miljour, who is currently on assignment in Bridgetown. And we have Megan Lau, who is serving right now in the office of our security assistant deputy minister. And we have Shala Mohammed, who is in our trade policy world. And thank you very much, all of you, for joining us today for this discussion. It's an important one, and I think you, I'll be keen to hear your perspectives and your wisdom over the course of the chat. Peut-être on peut commencer avec Myriam. Comme chef de notre secrétariat, quel est votre rôle, Myriam, et quelles sont vos réflexions concernant le type de tâches que nous avons avoir comme communauté et comme organisation?
Thank you for the question, Deputy Ministers. So to begin with, I would like first to contextualize the genesis of the GAC Anti-Racism Secretariat, because that sets the foundation for what my role is as head of the Anti-Racism Secretariat. So we all know that following the murder of George Floyd and other recorded instances of police brutality against Black and Indigenous peoples in North America, and the subsequent global outcry that this has generated for racial equality and justice, the issue of anti-Black racism, anti-Indigenous racism, and racial discrimination in Canada within the public service and the department has been brought to the forefront. Throughout the summer of 2020, you and your colleagues at Global Affairs have heard from and taken part in several discussions with Black, Indigenous, and other racialized staff. Those discussions focused on how racism continues to limit the contribution of these employees, their advancement, and how it does perpetuate outmoded ideas and thinking in ways that are sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious, systemic, and can even be structural. And that, of course, significantly undermines and sometimes even negates the importance of diversity and inclusion. So with that in mind, the Anti-Racism Secretariat was created to support departmental actions and on systemic racism, racial discrimination, and the full inclusion of Black, Indigenous, and other racialized people in our department. The Secretariat spearheads the work to make Global Affairs Canada an equitable and inclusive workplace that is representative of the Canadians that we serve. So as part of our work, we focus on actions under three pillars: representation at all levels, career development, and anti-racist values, principles, and training, with the objective, of course, to end systemic racism in the department and address racial discrimination. As the head of the Secretariat, I report directly to the Associate Deputy Ministers of Foreign Affairs, Chris McLennan, and I provide strategic advice to all of you, deputy ministers. I also play a key role in supporting the deputies as we shape Global Affairs Canada anti-racism strategy. Along with my team, we work closely with senior management and we collaborate with GAC's human resource branch, departmental champions, the networks for visible minority and Indigenous peoples, central agencies, other government departments and stakeholders, so that we can advance and promote the importance of equity, diversity, and inclusion for everyone. My goal for 2021 will be to lay the groundwork for systemic sustainable change in the department. We started the year strong with an endorsement from the Executive Committee on the Anti-Racism Framework, which now serves as the guiding piece that will assist in the development of the anti-racism strategy. The development of the strategy and the consultation process are well underway, and the goal will be to take this strategy and the associated action plan to the Executive Committee in the upcoming weeks. We're working hard to advance and have in place this fiscal year several key initiatives, including launching an anti-racism employee survey this spring. The results of the survey will be used to establish a baseline of where the department is at today on organizational culture, sense of belonging, personal experience, and interpersonal relationships. It will also allow us to assess progress in these regards in the future. It will be conducted on an annual basis going forward. We have also established the Deputy Minister's Advisory Committee on Anti-Racism, which will have its inaugural meeting on March 26. And we are thrilled to have you and Deputy Minister McLennan co-chairing the first meeting. The committee will be providing feedback and advice to deputy ministers on specific actions as they take shape to end systemic racism at all levels and in all forms in the department. And I'm pleased to say that the first agenda item will be on the pilot sponsorship program. The program's main objective is to ensure high potential aspiring candidates from underrepresented groups have access to promotional opportunities, and it ensures that these candidates are given equal considerations for projects, development opportunities, and more importantly, advancement. Finally, the Secretariat, as you know, has supported CFSI in the development of an anti-racism training for EXs entitled Challenging Racism in the Workplace, the Role of Leadership. And we continue to support the Institute in the development of the online anti-racism training for all employees that is expected to launch this spring. So as you can see, we have several big initiatives planned this year that are being led by the Secretariat, and there are others in the strategic plan that are aimed at increasing representation at all levels and fostering an equitable and inclusive environment an inclusive environment for all. I will add one more thing, and I know that I've taken lots of space, Deputy, but you did ask me the question.
I asked you the question. That's
exactly. So I will add one more thing. Although leadership accountability is central to ensuring successful outcomes, let's not forget that we each have a role to play in ending systemic racism and addressing racial discrimination. This is a collective responsibility. Inaction is not an option, and staying silent is not acceptable.
Well, you've actually anticipated the question I was going to ask you. So thank you for all the work you're doing in the first place. I think it's incredibly important, and it's essential to the kind of realization of the objectives that we've set for the department and that the public service has been set by the clerk and that the Prime Minister expects from all of us. And I think it couldn't be more important. But I wanted to ask you about that last point. Vous avez discuté un grand nombre de politiques qui sont absolument essentielles pour réaliser nos buts. Mais en même temps, il y a un aspect de ce type de travail qui est culturel et qui est plus interpersonnel, si on peut dire. Et ça, c'est un peu plus difficile de traiter. Et quelles sont les stratégies pour assurer que le plus grand nombre de membres de notre ministère sont sensibles de tous les objectifs de notre travail ensemble?
Absolument. Je pense que ça commence avec le pilier que j'ai mentionné autour des valeurs et des principes antiracistes. Donc, on a parlé de la formation. Au niveau de la formation, on veut vraiment s'assurer que ce dossier-là reste dans les esprits de tous les individus sur une base constante. Donc, ça veut dire que la formation n'est que le début. Le dialogue doit continuer de façon constante. Mais un des aspects qu'on pousse aussi, c'est cette notion de développer des plans d'équité, de diversité, d'inclusion. Et je pense que ça aussi, c'est un élément qui est important parce que ça permet à l'organisation, aux dirigeants, aux employés, de toujours garder ces éléments-là en tête et de prendre des actions concrètes pour être en mesure de faire une différence. À cela s'ajoute le sondage dont je viens de parler. Le sondage va nous aider à avoir une meilleure compréhension de la situation dans le ministère et de quelle façon on est en mesure de pouvoir régler ces problématiques-là et de continuer à les garder en tête. Et je pense que l'autre chose, c'est vraiment, on doit tous se sentir confortable dans nos inconforts, parce que ce ne sont pas des conversations faciles à avoir. Donc, ça veut dire que il y a certaines personnes qui vont se sentir inconfortables, qui vont se sentir mal à l'aise, mais ça fait partie du processus. On n'est pas capable de pouvoir gérer ces problématiques si on n'est pas conscient de la problématique et puis si on ne se sent pas à l'aise d'en parler ouvertement. Donc, je pense que ça, c'est important également. Je pense que finalement, en bout de ligne, c'est cette notion aussi de se sentir en mesure de pouvoir parler, de ne pas se taire quand on constate qu'il y a des comportements qui sont inadéquats dans le ministère. Et ça, ça veut dire que les gens doivent se sentir à l'aise de pouvoir parler de leurs expériences sans avoir peur des répercussions. Donc, je pense que comme ministère, on a une responsabilité à ce niveau-là de s'assurer que tout le monde est à l'aise et que ces sujets-là peuvent être discutés de façon très ouverte. Maintenant, comme vous le savez, monsieur le sous-ministre, le changement de culture, ce n'est pas quelque chose qui se fait overnight, qui se fait très, très rapidement. Donc, ça va prendre du temps. Mais ce que je dirais, c'est qu'on est sur la bonne voie parce qu'il y a vraiment une volonté très claire dans le ministère de faire une différence.
Yeah, thank you, Miriam. I think that's right. I think, obviously, cultural change is something that is, by its nature, a little bit more gradual than policy changes, for instance. But at least in my own reflection on this, it does feel, I feel like those of us who are in leadership positions in the department have a particular responsibility to keep reinforcing just how important it is that this is, we have a particular leadership role in ensuring that the department is going in the direction that we all wanted to go. But all members of the department have a role here as well in really making tangible the changes that we want to see. And that's partially, I think, a reflection of just the individual circumstances, some parts of the department as well. We are a great big place, and there are individual cultures that exist in various corners of it. And I guess I wanted to turn to Sala right now and just get your input, Sala, about some of the work that's been done in the T branch, because I know, it's just as an example of some of the more specific efforts that have been pursued, and you and your colleagues have taken a very active role in this, and I'm kind of interested in the lessons you've learned through that, and anything that you think would be important to share with the broader community.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Shala here from T Branch. Last June, I'd say I stepped into two volunteer roles: Visible Minority Network co-rep for T Branch and co-champion for diversity and inclusion. And the latter role is alongside our existing, DG diversity inclusion champion, and at that point, we were pretty keen to do something concrete, to develop an action plan, and we did that with a volunteer working group of Black, Indigenous, and people of color, coined as BIPOC, employees and allies, right? So folks not necessarily from within that community. It's since been endorsed by branch senior management and is now being implemented. So, to comment on our work in the branch, let me just maybe highlight three aspects of our action plan. So, and I'd say that, from Miriam's points on the work of the Anti-Racism Secretariat, I feel like there's a degree of alignment between what we're doing and the leadership of the Secretariat. I know that we've also been in touch with the Secretariat during the development of that action plan. So just to say that that's been really valuable in that whole process. So, our plan has commitments to create a diverse and representative workforce with a target of at least 25% representation of BIPOC employees at all levels. And that's a floor, not a ceiling. And, some early impacts in that regard have been a staffing guide for all hiring managers and a pilot mentorship program that prioritizes BIPOC employees. The second, and this is really, I think related to that culture change piece, so what can we do to foster an inclusive and respectful workplace, through things like dialogue and mandatory or strongly advised training. So I'll point to an example this month. We're rolling out a full day anti-racism workshop that's mandatory for all branch employees. And, having sat in the first session, I thought it was really great. And it was being delivered by Monte Malepo, who may be familiar to folks. Third, we're of the view that evidence and expertise need to guide our work. So we're hoping to bring in a consultant to do what we call a deep dive on where the whole of the branch is at with issues such as systemic racism and discrimination. To note the gaps or barriers in our plan, and if so, how do we recalibrate as needed? And on to the second part of what you asked, Deputy, observations. So I'd outlined three, and I think they're similar to Miriam's reflections, and also with the caveat that we're in the early stages of implementation. So inevitably, I think we'll find that there are things that we could have done better. But on to the first. I mean, these are complex issues, and I think they pointed to the need for expertise and capacity. So things like lived experience are super important, but they don't, I think, and I'd welcome views from others, right? But I don't think they replace professional expertise. Someone who is, and I'm saying nods, so, facilitating uncomfortable or solution-oriented discussions and dialogues and knowing how to bridge those gaps, right? People are in various stages of their anti-racism journeys, as we know. And so, that compounded with the fact that you're volunteering, in general has its challenges, but with it being off the side of your desk. But when it comes to anti-racism work, I think there's a bit of an irony, right? When the mainly affected group, the BIPOC community, tends to bear the heaviest burden to create solutions or to educate people. The second, I think, observation is that allyship and alignment are key. So, and I'm talking about real, not performative allyship. And I just say in our experience in T Branch, our volunteers are not just dedicated folks from the BIPOC community, but they're also great allies. And quite frankly, we're in need of more. In particular, I want to point out that we've been supported by a really strong ally in senior management, and that's my co-champion, Kendall Humbroff, who's been there to take the time to listen, to learn, to unlearn, to roll up her sleeves and to talk through how are we going to bring these issues to senior management and put it on the table. And just on alignment, I mean, we talk about policy windows. I hope folks don't mind me kind of bringing that concept into this sort of discussion, but the overall environment was, and I think still remains, relatively conducive for this kind of work to initiate and materialize. I don't think that was the case really before last June, but these issues are longstanding and not new to the communities that are most affected by them. But there's been a bit of alignment here that's helped us. And I'll try to keep it brief in the interest of time, but this third point, which Miriam, you also brought up, is that time, right? These things take time, and that, there are no quick fixes to end systemic racism. It's sustained effort, attention, and commitment to do what's needed. I think we're in a mainstream-ish context now starting to unravel and unpack how our institutions have been designed, the inherently exclusionary results specifically in relation to race and what to do about it. So things like dialogue, training, and PMA commitments, they're good first steps, But you need to be able, and leaders in particular, need to be able to dig deeper, walk the talk, avoid picking the easy wins and turning this into a box checking exercise. And ultimately, don't forget about it when the headlines fade. So, I mean, we're like a year in, and I think just scratching the surface. I'll close, though, with some cautious optimism. I'm hopeful that the department, so, you know, deputies, management, people with privilege, and just anyone listening, right, that, you know, because it requires everyone, right, to be involved, that we can collectively ensure that this time will be different, that we will be on the right side of history. And, you know, Miriam, I was thinking about sustainable and equitable systemic change before you mentioned it, really, just like a strong sign of alignment there, and the influence of, you know, your work and the Secretariat. But ultimately, you know, that we're able to achieve that. And with these hopes, you know, I hope I'm not wrong.
Thank you, Shella. Those are very thoughtful comments. And I think if I could just pick up one point there, there's an awful lot we could pursue. But I think the thing I've been struck by is the point that you've raised about the burden being borne by members of the BIPOC community, because I think that's just right. And it's something that I'm very conscious of. I know my colleagues in the deputy community are very conscious of. And, you know, I think we certainly, or I guess I'd make a couple points. One of them is, this is on us. This is not on the visible minorities community. This is on us. And we are responsible for the direction of the department, and we're responsible for addressing where we're falling short of where we need to be. We benefit enormously from the leadership and the engagement of you and your colleagues in ensuring that we are taking actions that are relevant. And that's why the conversations that we're having right now and the conversations that you have chaired in other contexts are so important, not because they are the responsibility of the people who are participating in those conversations, and nor should they be exclusive conversations, because it's what's absolutely critical is that this is something that is part of the everyday life of our department across the department. But I am deeply appreciative of the insight that we've received because of people being brave enough to share their experiences and being prepared to. So maybe I'll turn to Megan. And we've heard a bit about the work that's been done in the T branch, but Megan, you come to this from the I branch, and again, another of our cultures within the broad family of global affairs. Maybe you could just share with us some of the work that's been done in the context of your branch.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be part of this discussion. So I'm going to try not to tread the same ground as Shella did, because obviously, you know, we're all talking to each other. Shella and I actually haven't spoken before, but certainly there's a big network of those of us who've been working on these issues, and it's been invaluable over the last 9 months or so to be sharing ideas, bouncing ideas off each other. And I would include Miriam and her remarkable team in that. They have been such a resource, such a sounding board for various ideas as we'd want to try them on for the branch. So what I'd say right off the bat is that this has been, the iBranch's work has been a collaboration. And so like many of us here, I think the conversation in the iBranch really started last June. And over the summer, a number of conversations happened, some directly between our ADM, Dan Costello, staff in the branch, others from various communities with me. Certainly the Visible Minority Network has played an invaluable role in contributing their thoughts, their views, staff who identify as Indigenous, staff who are part of the Pride Network. It's been a really rich conversation. And so on the basis of those conversations and discussions, and a lot of using the HR branch as well as a sounding board, our ADM circulated with the endorsement of senior management last October a list of commitments related to diversity and inclusion. And so they fall into four broad areas, again, closely aligned with what T-Branch is working on, with which Miriam's team is working on. learning and training, recruitment, retention and promotion, and finally some data. I won't go through all of them, so I'm going to focus instead on what I think of as more of an HR nerdy side of the picture for what we've done, because I think that's incredibly important, focusing on the people side of the equation and how exactly we make sure that we recruit people from diverse and especially underrepresented backgrounds, and how we support them so that we retain them and so that we promote them. So one of the commitments that was circulated by Dan last October was to work with colleagues in HBranch to develop guidance for managers. So something very much along the lines, I think, of what Shala was describing. Managers, we found, wanted to do more, but they weren't necessarily available with all the tools, familiar with all the tools that were available to them and hadn't all experienced them. So we developed this guidance, and then that's sort of been a springboard for us to do a number of different small-scale initiatives that I think of all as really as little pilot projects to see, you know, what is it that we can do on the HR side within the control strictly of our branch, because we're obviously not yet at a point where we've got GAC-wide initiatives, but what can we do just within our branch? So I'll just give you a little bit of a capsule description of three things that we've been trying out. So the first I'd describe as just looking within. Miriam, I'm going to quote you, but last week in a webinar, you said, you know, the problem I think is not a lack of diversity, but a lack of inclusion. And so what we wanted to do as a branch was look within and see, you know, we all talk about situations where we have staff who are from underrepresented groups clustered at lower levels. So we looked at our branch, and sure enough, you know, that's what we found. So a series of small steps were taken, and very much managers pulling together, working to sort of solve these kinds of situations. One instance where we had somebody in a role that was definitely not making use of her skills, her ability, her knowledge, her degrees, her training, all of this. That person was loaned out to another division, short-term acting assignment, but to give her the opportunity to work in a lot, to do some work that's closely related to her studies. Elsewhere, you know, again, you know, we all abstractly, I think, you know, there's a challenge around official languages for staff who are from visible minorities in particular. So the branch, and you know, more instances than I count, we've decided, whether through non-imperative staffing or through commitments to train staff, to make sure that we invest in these staff whose career prospects are hampered by the fact that they don't speak or write at a sufficient level a second official language. So that's, we've tried out, you know, baby steps, early days, lots more to be done, but I think we've had some successes there already. And that really happened because managers pulled together and worked to find solutions across the branch. Second initiative, I'd like to think of it as looking outside the box. And I'm going to shamelessly plug an IRCC program here that was brought to my attention by the H branch. But IRCC has a program called the Federal Internship for Newcomers Program. IRCC screens staff or potential candidates, newcomers, so new immigrants to Canada who want to work in the government or elsewhere, but especially the government. And then they develop a pool. As a manager, it is remarkable. You can call over to IRCC, or I actually drop an email, and within a day, you receive these CVs for staff who speak multiple languages, potential staff who speak multiple languages, have graduate degrees, law degrees, international experience. Frankly, it's staggering. And I think what's a little bit disheartening is that you see that in many cases, these staff, or these potential staff again, I say staff because we've actually hired three of them in the branch in the last 6 months, these people are working in customer service jobs. They're in call centers. We're not tapping into that reservoir of potential the way we could. So the branch has made efforts to hire from through this program. We've had remarkable results so far. And just to give you a really concrete example, someone was looking for someone with peacekeeping expertise. So I went out on a limb. I asked IRCC, did they have someone? Within 24 hours, six CVs for people with peacekeeping degrees or experience. One of them, I think, had 20 years in the UN system and had recently immigrated to Canada. So tremendous experience. We just need to know where to look to tap into it. So looking outside the box a little bit in terms of who we hire. And then the final thing I'll talk about is when I think about looking towards the future and to think carefully about student recruitment. Again, this too, it's a drop in the bucket of what we need to do, but it's so important to think about who we're bringing into the department, who's likely to join us a few years down the road when they graduate. And so the branch experimented this year with its student recruitment effort, and we targeted in our advertisement people who would self-identify as part of an employment equity group. We were spoiled for choice again. I think this is maybe the theme of what I'm saying today, but spoiled for choice in the CVs we received. We've screened them, we've hired people, very excited to have a number of staff from underrepresented groups joining us this summer. And as we look ahead, one of the things we want to do as a branch is think through how do we make these staff not just join us for the summer, because that's maybe the easy part, but how do we make them feel welcome and included and want to stay? So we're looking at onboarding materials and onboarding programs and buddy programs, things to make sure that, you know, they build the network that will help them, that will help them stay in the department and thrive. So that's some of what we're doing. Again, all small steps, but a huge collaboration across the branch and with support from all over the place to try to take some first small steps.
That's terrific. Those are really interesting examples too. And I think, as you say, one of the challenges is to make sure we not only think outside the box, but also then make sure that we are promoting inclusion as a part and parcel of the overall conversation that we're having here, because it is so essential to then be able to make sure, as you say, that we can take advantage of the people who are there to offer extraordinary services. And that's something that's in the interests of all Canadians. Jenna, vos perspectives sont intéressantes parce que vous êtes collègue autochtone de Première Nation, mais vous êtes aussi en affectation. Alors, il y a une série de perspectives qui sont pertinentes pour notre conversation aujourd'hui. Quelles sont vos réflexions en ce qui concerne ces sujets?
Bonjour, merci Jana Ndijnikal. Ça me fait vraiment plaisir d'être avec vous. Je vous remercie pour vos partages jusqu'à date. Je suis vraiment... il y a plein de choses que je me rends compte que je ne sais pas qui se passe au ministère et c'est vraiment formidable. Alors, avant d'entamer mes réponses, de partager mes réponses, j'aimerais d'abord commencer par reconnaître qu'il y a certainement nombreux écouteurs qui sont situés en territoires autochtones qui n'ont jamais été cédés. Et je vous invite donc tous à en faire la recherche et la reconnaissance en guise de respect aux liens du passé, au présent et l'avenir des relations avec les peuples autochtones. Alors voilà, je passe un peu à vous parler un peu de mes expériences. Alors, ça fait 12 ans que je suis au ministère. Je suis en première affectation. Et lorsque j'ai vraiment essayé de faire un... compiler tout ça en quelques minutes pour partager quelques éléments clés, c'est que je ne peux aborder la question sans parler d'expériences positives que j'ai eues, donc qui m'ont énormément apporté en tant que dans mon processus d'affirmation identitaire. Donc, j'ai eu la chance de rencontrer des communautés autochtones en Amérique latine. J'ai aussi rencontré des collègues autochtones au ministère qui sont devenus des mentors. Ça a eu un énorme impact. Et j'ai aussi eu la chance de travailler avec quelques gestionnaires, même avant 2020, qui ont valorisé énormément mon identité autochtone et qui m'ont donné des opportunités en fonction de cela, même si ça dépassait un peu la description des tâches comme telles de mon poste. Alors, je vais d'abord commencer par le côté positif. Et il faut aussi dire que j'ai eu des expériences négatives aussi qui ont laissé des malaises qui ont pris vraiment beaucoup de temps à décortiquer. Je le sens déjà dans ma voix que j'ai encore une nervosité des fois à en parler parce que c'est un énorme processus personnel et professionnel pour vraiment comprendre comment on vit une expérience négative dans le milieu du travail. Tout comme Myriam l'a dit, je pense que c'est vraiment un processus. Il y a un processus d'apprentissage pour changer, mais il y a aussi un processus de compréhension de ce qu'on vit. Donc, selon moi, ces expériences négatives-là ont surtout été semées par une mal-éducation, des préjugés, des perceptions racistes, des approches discriminatoires qui sont vraiment appuyées par des systèmes, puis aussi peut-être un refus de reconnaître qu'on travaille encore avec des façons de faire qui continuent de créer des entraves et qui continuent d'exclure. Et je vais vous donner vraiment un exemple concret ça m'a pris du temps d'en partager. En fait, je l'ai dit pour la toute première fois à quelqu'un, tout simplement à l'automne, alors que ça s'est passé il y a 2 ans. C'est quand j'ai été sélectionnée pour venir à la Barbade ici en poste, il y a quelqu'un qui m'a dit que c'était parce que je cochais 2 cases, femme et autochtone. Et ça m'a pris énormément de temps, vraiment, je crois que je me suis dit, on laisse tomber ça, on n'écoute pas. Mais dans mon processus d'affirmation identitaire, il fallait absolument que je passe par le processus de décortiquer d'où ça venait ça et que ça n'avait rien à voir avec moi, en fait. Donc, pour moi, ça a été vraiment ça peut sembler banal pour certaines personnes, mais en fait, non, ça a eu un méchant gros impact parce que ça nie complètement tout mon parcours, tout ce que j'ai fait, tous les efforts, toutes les collaborations et tout ça. Donc, pour moi, donc c'était l'exemple vraiment que je voulais vous partager aujourd'hui. Et pour en revenir un peu sur le positif, dans un sens, c'est que, comme mes collègues ont partagé, c'est vraiment le summum de toutes ces expériences-là qui ont mené à ma motivation de vouloir participer, de contribuer. Dans le fond, ces efforts de lutte contre le racisme et la discrimination au ministère, même si ça va au-delà des tâches comme telles avec mon poste. Donc, c'est vraiment j'ai rencontré des personnes formidables. Tu sais, mon engagement au mandat du secrétariat avec le réseau des peuples autochtones, les autres réseaux d'employés, tous ces comités, ces sous-groupes qui existent maintenant au sein des directions générales, c'est composé de gens avec tant de vécu, de bonté, de volonté. Et c'est là que j'ai trouvé une solidarité et vraiment un esprit de, comment dire, c'est un esprit de solidarité qui me permettait, dans le fond, de comprendre beaucoup mieux ce que je vis en tant qu'employée autochtone au sein du ministère, parce qu'il y a un genre d'unité, de compréhension silencieuse parfois, de juste avoir vécu des choses qui nous ont fait sentir d'une certaine façon. Et je voulais aussi dire, dans cette question-là, lorsqu'on parle d'identité autochtone et de valeurs canadiennes, parfois ça peut sembler comme une dualité, surtout représenter le Canada à l'étranger, alors qu'il y a encore tant de difficultés, de problèmes au Canada. Et pour moi, ça forme un tout parce que c'est qui je suis. Je suis une femme, je suis fière d'être une femme des Premières Nations et je suis fière d'être canadienne et je suis fière de représenter ce que tout ça veut dire pour moi lorsque je suis à l'étranger ou quand je fais des missions à l'étranger pour visiter des projets, des partenaires et tout ça. Donc c'est ça. Puis, pour continuer un peu sur quelques éléments de cette question-là et que Chala a soulevé aussi, c'est que, en ce qui a trait à l'avenir, j'ai énormément d'espoir. Mais je ressens aussi beaucoup d'inquiétude que ça ne soit que de passage, non pas à l'égard de la résilience autochtone, mais plutôt de la volonté concrète des gens au pouvoir et de nous tous en tant que citoyens canadiens, en tant que fonctionnaires canadiens et des efforts qui sont vraiment requis pour, dans le fond, faire avancer cette équité et ce qu'on veut dire par la réconciliation. Et sur la réconciliation, je suis vraiment d'avis, ça m'a pris du temps à comprendre tout ça, mais je suis d'avis qu'on ne peut pas parler de réconciliation sans agir pour assurer le respect des droits des peuples autochtones. Évidemment, j'encourage et je participe à tous les efforts qui contribuent à la mise en œuvre des 94 appels à l'action de la Commission de vérité et de réconciliation, mais je propose aussi une piste de réflexion. Comment peut-on réellement redéfinir la relation entre les peuples autochtones au Canada et le Canada alors qu'il y a des communautés, des peuples autochtones qui n'ont toujours pas accès à l'eau potable, qui est un droit fondamental? Donc, pour moi, c'est une piste de réflexion très importante. Et pour terminer sur cette question de qu'est-ce qui me donne l'espoir, c'est que c'est vraiment, voilà, nous voilà aujourd'hui, parce qu'on en discute. Ça prend énormément de courage et je le constate avec des collègues autochtones, d'autres collègues qui sont issus de communautés marginalisées. C'est notre présence, notre essor collectif. Et je dois dire aussi que j'ai fait beaucoup la rencontre de nouveaux jeunes professionnels au ministère et il y a maintenant un refus du statu quo. Et ça, c'est vraiment formidable. Je suis extrêmement inspirée par cette nouvelle génération. Et comme d'autres l'ont dit, ce qui m'inspire, c'est de voir des gens qui osent, des gens au ministère, qui osent se remettre en question, de sentir cet inconfort et de passer à l'action, et non pas pour le rendement ou la performance, mais parce que c'est la chose à faire, il est temps. Et pour respecter les droits, mettre fin à des inégalités et intégrer ces richesses des communautés marginalisées dont on ne profite pas en ce moment.
Well, look, thank you very much to all of you. There was a lot of wisdom in those comments, and I appreciate you taking the time to share that with our community more generally. And I as I said over the course of the conversation, I'm really very grateful to all four of you for your leadership on these issues. And this is obviously a work that is of central importance to the department, and you're making a huge contribution to it. And I look forward to continuing these conversations with each of you. So thank you so much. All best wishes.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us for future episodes of The GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada. Don't forget to join the conversation online using hashtag GACFiles.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado, et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour les épisodes futurs des dossiers d'AMC. Un balado sur les gens, les enjeux et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada. N'oubliez pas de vous joindre à la conversation en ligne en utilisant le hashtag #DossierDAMC.
If you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics or guests, please send us an email at extott-ldce@international.gc.ca.
Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant des sujets futurs ou des nouveaux invités, vous pouvez communiquer avec nous par courriel à l'adresse extott-ldce@commercialinternational.gc.ca.